The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, your public radio station for more than 32 years, and this is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, July 18th, 2017. I'm Kyle Kellums. If you mark the advancement of summer in milestones, the end of Wimbledon or the last Gully Park concert, for example, here is one of those markers. The school supply drive for Samaritan Community Center is Friday and Saturday. Supplies, including rulers, highlighters, binders, spiral notebooks, and other items, will be accepted at Northwest Arkansas Chick-fil-A restaurants Friday and Saturday. Last year, more than $3,000 worth of supplies were donated. You can find out more at Samaritan Community Center's website. That's samcc.org. Ahead on today's show, another indicator summer is advancing. The University of Arkansas Theater Department is readying the 2017-18 season. It includes Tennessee Williams, Avenue Q, new works, progress on a new theater, and the single most intimate theater experience possible, a performance for just you and only you. Michael Rhea, the chair of the department, will explain later on today's Ozarks at Large. First, a restoration specialist who has restored everything from artifacts brought up from the Titanic to Martin Luther King Jr.'s Bible is working on a plane in Benton County. Gordon Ponsford has also restored all of the monuments and sculptures at Arlington National Cemetery. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek met with him in Gravette, where there's a U.S. Air Force plane that was in need of some attention.
Gordon Ponsford and his crew are buffing away the decals on the T-33 trainer that sits along Main Street at Field Kinley Memorial Park.
Nice little plane. You find them periodically in these little townships. They're on loan from the Air Force Heritage Program.
By the time we meet at the park Sunday morning, Ponsford has been working on the plane for a couple of days, and parts of the T-33 have been returned to their former shine. The years the plane has spent outside are particularly noticeable when you see the restored aluminum side by side with the portions Ponsford's crew hasn't gotten to yet. Parts of the plane are also covered in small round dents left behind by hail, and Ponsford says they're replacing some of the metal.
Unfortunately, a little bit of some holes punctured in, and that generally occurs from lawnmowers and stuff like that. So we're addressing all that and cutting out all the bad metal and putting some new metal in.
He says they're using aluminum panels similar to aeronautical aluminum, but because the plane isn't flying anywhere, they're sparing that extra expense.
There's also a black stripe going down the front of the nose that's no longer there. That's faded away, and we're going to replace that. And that kind of stopped the sun from shining into the eyes of the pilots when they're flying.
Ponsford and his crew are also using paper and tape to outline the words U.S. Air Force that appear on either side of the plane's nose so they can strip away the blue paint and repaint the words in black. Ponsford says that's the original color of the letters. Restoring things is in Ponsford's blood. He says he's been interested in it ever since he was a child.
My grandfather had body shops in England and junkyards. It was close to an American Air Force base, and my father was American. Met my mom in England. While he was in Korea, we grew up around my granddad's body shop and junkyard and petrol stations. So you're kind of either in the mechanical side of it or in the body shop side. I kind of swayed towards the body shop side.
Ponsford says for him, restoration is largely about breaking things down to the materials they're made out of and then finding the best methods to clean them off. Because the plane Ponsford is working on is on loan from the Air Force Heritage Program, Gravette Mayor Kurt Maddox says the city has certain obligations it has to meet.
We sign a contract every so often that states we must keep the plane in specific shape. And when I read through it, I realized if I'm signing off on this as the mayor of the city that we need to make sure we are doing what we say we're doing.
Maddox says the insurance on the plane covered $10,000 worth of repairs, and the city matched that amount. But there was one problem.
Insurance had come, looked at it, and they had decided it did have a lot of issues that needed to be worked on. And for a long time, we couldn't find anybody who could work on it. And we looked everywhere, insurance, couldn't find anybody either.
Eventually, the city decided to wait until Ponsford says he found the plane himself.
We were going through another township in North Dakota, and they also have a T-33 like this one. And we stopped because we were on our way to one of the Air Force bases to do the museum collection of planes. Come to find out they needed theirs restored. So we gave it some thought, and we reached out to the Air Force Heritage Program, got the list, and did a mailing.
And that's how Ponsford came across the T-33 in Gravett that was put up at Field Kinley Park. Kinley was a World War I fighter pilot.
Field Kinley was a local boy. He grew up in his uncle's house, which is right next door here in the museum. He enlisted in 1917. He became one of the top five aces in World War I. An ace is a pilot who has shot down at least five enemy aircraft.
That's Alfred Blair. He's one of the Gravett Museum Commission members. He says Kinley survived the war, but died shortly after in a flying accident when he was leading a training exercise. He was 23. Blair says the T-33 honors Kinley's distinguished service, even though that type of plane didn't exist until decades later.
The plane that Field Kinley flew, of course, was made out of wood and canvas. That type of plane would not hold up well in an exterior environment.
The T-33, though, has been at Kinley Park for decades, and Gordon Ponsford says he's restoring more than just the monument.
You bring back some historically significant items for the township because it represents all the veterans. And it, you know, when you bring it back and restore it, you're honoring them, not just the plane.
Ponsford says he expects the whole restoration to take a little over a week. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
After he's done with the plane in Gravett, Ponsford says he and his crew will head to an Air Force base in Colorado to restore a plane collection there. The planned removal of an old home in a downtown Fayetteville residential district is raising some interest in creating a municipal historic preservation ordinance in the city. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich explains more.
The two-story red brick mansion with a wraparound pedestal porch is called the Stone Hilton House. It stands on a half acre of lawn on the corner of Lafayette and Willow Streets, one of five declared National Register of Historic Districts in Fayetteville. Andrew Garner is director of city planning.
You know, from a national standpoint, this neighborhood is worthy of designation, but the Park Service does not then come in from the federal level and say, we now want to regulate you. That's all handled at a local level. So it's a local political decision whether or not to have extra standards so the property owners in those districts can do whatever they want to their structures in Fayetteville.
Because Fayetteville has no historic preservation ordinance on the books, that means owners can demolish historic homes and businesses at will.
My understanding is it's one of the oldest buildings, you know, oldest homes in Fayetteville.
Jason Smith owns a 100-year-old house just down the street from the Stone Hilton House in the Washington Willow District.
I hate to see older homes that may have some historical significance get torn down without someone at least reviewing that.
Fayetteville City Planner Andrew Garner.
We have a section of codes called nonconforming structures, and that is really referring to structures that do not conform to the current zoning code. You know, they may have been built many decades ago, and they're called grandfathered in. As far as we don't call that in the code, we call them nonconforming structures. But in our code, we talk about how those nonconforming structures are encouraged to continue and be adapted for different uses.
Andrew Garner says Fayetteville's long-term 2030 plan is primarily focused on revitalization.
We really do, as a city, from a historic cultural standpoint, from an environmental standpoint, from a neighborhood revitalization standpoint, revitalizing old structures is a really fantastic way to accomplish all of those goals. And a lot of times those old buildings are the ones that really contribute the character to a place. And really, you know, those are the neighborhoods where even if you just have three or four really cool old homes, you know, that really can make a difference in how the neighborhood feels.
But strict historic preservation codes require owners to maintain the integrity of original architecture. Andrew Garner says at this juncture, no historic preservation ordinances have been proposed, but the likely demolition of the Stone Hilton House has raised interest.
It really is going to have to come from the neighborhood because it's really a local decision. And, you know, if the neighbors that live in that neighborhood do not want to regulate themselves, the chances of that actually happening are probably very low.
Washington Willow District resident Jason Smith says he and his neighbors are very interested.
Well, we're hoping to. We did have a neighborhood meeting. The mayor came to the meeting, and yeah, I think a lot of people were able to express their concerns about that. And we talked a little bit about the process. It does take the majority of the neighborhood to sign on for that. So we'll see if we have enough people to get behind it.
But Andrew Garner says it's unlikely that Fayetteville would ever adopt a blanket historic preservation code, for example, like the city of Eureka Springs. Garner says it would take an agreement of 50% of property owners to regulate themselves and establish boundaries. He says city council could agree to regulate structures within declared National Register districts, collaborating with owners, and it tried once.
I mean, the last time we tried it, we approached the city staff and at the direction, I think, of the administration, approached business owners in historic Dixon Street. And we attempted to get them to create regulations for the historic preservation of Dixon Street. And we did not have support at all from the property owners. And at that point, we abandoned the idea and said, okay, if it's going to be that contentious and the citizens of Fayetteville don't want this preserved in a local regulation, then, you know, at that point we stopped our efforts.
As mentioned, a historic preservation code has been in place in Eureka Springs for almost 50 years. The popular tourist destination was also the first city to be listed in its entirety on the National Register of Historic Places. Mayor Butch Berry, who is native of Eureka and a practicing preservation architect, says City Council, at the urging of concerned resident artists in 1969, passed an ordinance to preserve the downtown's hand-cut limestone commercial structures and Victorian-era residential homes, many of which stood derelict at the time.
Decided that Eureka Springs needed to become, establish a mechanism to make sure that the architecture would survive modernization.
Eureka's preservation ordinance is administered by the Historic District Commission. Residents must schedule formal presentations before commission members who issue a certificate of appropriateness for permitted improvements, from paint color to roof shingles, original fixtures, and contributing historical structures, like windows and doors, cannot be replaced, only repaired. Those who do not comply face fines. But Mayor Berry says most residents are compliant.
I think so. I mean, we do have some who sometimes feel like they should, they feel like it's too complicated to go through the process and that it's easier to ask forgiveness than permission.
When historic buildings or homes subject to preservation ordinances are sold in Eureka Springs, realtors must mention it to buyers, and sellers must disclose that information in real estate contracts. According to Ken Riley, a realtor with Century 21 Woodland in Eureka Springs, due to decades of preservation efforts by both the city and residents, Eureka Springs has not only received numerous awards, but millions of dollars in heritage tourism dollars.
You can be on the National Register with local significance, with state significance, or national significance. Eureka Springs recently was awarded national significance on the National Register. So we are really, in the United States, we are nationally significant in the order of historic preservation.
The same year Eureka Springs passed its preservation ordinance, the state of Arkansas created the Arkansas Historic Preservation Program, an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. The program seeks to add more of the state's historic structures to the National Register of Historic Places to spur rehabilitation rather than destruction. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And ahead on today's Ozarks at Large, political writer John Brumman has thought about the announcement that the University of Arkansas at Little Rock is considering adding football. He's not a fan of the idea.
I think it's a lame idea, and I also think it just reflects the simplicity of our thinking and just this silliness of our obsession with college football or college athletics.
John Brummett from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette talks with Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics later on today's show.
I'm Robin Young. Joe Berkowitz used to cringe when friends dropped a particularly painful pun until he witnessed his first Punderdome competition. Now he's a glutton for punishment.
Once I started going to these things, I very quickly saw how creative and clever they could be. And then I just noticed that there are puns everywhere.
Next time, Here and Now.
Today from 1 to 3 on 91.3. And tonight on Of Note, KUAF's locally produced program of classical music and the arts, Philip Glass and Joseph Haydn. You can hear 2 hours of handpicked classical music every Sunday through Thursday night from 8 to 10 on 91.3 KUAF. Glass, by the way, has been nominated for an Academy Award for 3 different movie soundtracks. Can you name them? The answer in just a moment. That's music from the soundtrack to The Hours from the Malcolm Hayward Music Library at KUAF. And that's one of the Oscar-nominated scores from Philip Glass. He also received nominations for Music Heard in Kundun and Notes on a Scandal. You can hear music from Philip Glass tonight on Of Note with Katie Hendrickson beginning at 8. Over the next few days, you have several chances to learn more and experience more about Arkansas-made art, ideas, and concepts. Tomorrow, Arkansas-based sign painter Olivia Trimble will offer a perspective on sign painting in the Ozarks during a discussion at Shiloh Museum of Ozark History in Springdale. She's the owner of Sleet City Signs, and she'll begin at the museum at noon tomorrow. It is free. Thursday night, speaking of free, Jeff Shannon will discuss the book Shadow Patterns, Reflections on Faye Jones and His Architecture. This takes place at the Fayetteville Public Library. The book collects essays and memories about Jones, a winner of the American Institute of Architects' highest honor, the Gold Medal. Shannon, a professor of architecture and former dean of the Faye Jones School of Architecture at the University of Arkansas, will discuss the book, published by the University of Arkansas Press, at 6 Thursday night at the Fayetteville Public Library. A film partially made in Arkansas about a fictional man from Arkansas will be screened Wednesday, July 26th, at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. The 1957 film A Face in the Crowd was directed by Elia Kazan and stars Andy Griffith as Lonesome Rhodes, an aw-shucks entertainer who becomes a political force through media manipulation. Andy Griffith is about as far away from Sheriff Taylor from Mayberry as you'll ever see him.
Twenty of the biggest men in this country coming to my banquet tomorrow night to get fighters for Fuller Rowland. Got a retired admiral from the Joint Chiefs, 2 governors, some of them big investment house boys, and a cabinet minister.
Which one?
I don't know. I told the general to pick one out for me.
Are they coming to your party?
Oh, honey, if I ask them, they gotta come. Maybe they'd be afraid not to come. I could murder them, like this.
Crystal Bridges will show A Face in the Crowd with Andy Griffith July 26th at 8:30. And before the film, there will be a discussion about Arkansas's film connections from the silent era through the 1950s with the co-authors of Lights, Camera, Arkansas, Suzanne McCrae and Robert Cochran, both of Fayetteville. The event is free, and you can learn more at crystalbridges.org. And it's hard to beat an Arkansas peach. Johnson County lays claim to the best of the bunch, and they celebrate every July with the Johnson County Peach Festival. The 76th edition of the festival begins Thursday in Clarksville. It's the oldest outdoor festival in the state, and you can find out more at the Johnson County Peach Festival Facebook page.
91.3 is supported by Urban Jungle Tropical Plant Care and Rental, offering a variety of indoor plants, living green walls, and outdoor planters for restaurants, offices, and homes. Urban Jungle, serving Benton and Washington counties with maintenance-free, month-to-month care and services. 466-5033 or urbanjunglenwa.com. The Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society presents the 19th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series. Kansas City jazz vocalist Lisa Henry and the Claudia Burson Quartet will open the season Saturday, July 29th, and jazz guitarist Alex Wentz and his trio performs Six Strings, Six Stories, tracing the lineage of the jazz guitar, August 19th. KUAF.com or digjazz.com for tickets.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums. Arkansas's U.S. senators are poised this week to vote for confirmation of Patrick Shanahan as Deputy Defense Secretary. His confirmation had met some resistance in the Armed Services Committee, on which Tom Cotton holds a seat, for a lack of specifics on a nuclear arms pact with Russia. Senator Cotton and others want the U.S. to ready for withdrawal from a Reagan-era agreement, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or the INF Treaty. The senator spoke yesterday at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, saying Russia is violating the 1987 agreement.
I would encourage the administration to take every action it can as well to put more pressure on Russia to bring it back into compliance. Right now, we have many European partners who want to play like ostriches, stick their head in the sands, pretend that Russia doesn't have this system because they don't want to face the consequences of making that announcement.
While Senator Cotton called on the Trump administration to compel Russia to comply or exit the nuclear arms treaty, he also praised the White House. Senator Cotton dismissed talk of electoral collusion and said the president has been much tougher on Russia than former President Barack Obama. Senator Cotton said a U.S. exit from the treaty could come this year as part of the National Defense Authorization Act. A firm located at the University of Arkansas Research and Technology Park will use a $750,000 award from the United States Air Force to develop electronics packaging for jet engine controls. Ozark Integrated Circuits Incorporated is working on controls that could be functional in temperatures of up to 300 degrees Celsius, or more than 450 degrees Fahrenheit. The company plans to continue to work with the University of Arkansas's High Density Electronics Center, also at the UA's Tech and Research Park. The Future School in Fort Smith is using a grant from Siloam Springs-based Wingate Foundation as a bit of fundraising momentum. According to Talk Business and Politics, the school has agreed to raise $300,000 over a three-year period to match an eventual $300,000 grant from the foundation. The Future School's first students began classes last August. The Future School is a tuition-free public charter high school in Fort Smith. Governor Asa Hutchinson has more than $1 million ready for his re-election campaign. The governor announced in May he would seek a second term in 2018. His campaign reports nearly $1.2 million in the bank. So far, no Democratic candidate has announced an intention to oppose the governor. A meeting Thursday afternoon in Bentonville will address a possible reconstruction of a dam in Bella Vista. The session is intended to foster discussion about Bella Vista Lake and the dam there. Members of the Bentonville City Council, Bentonville Planning Commission, and members of the city staff are expected to attend. The meeting is scheduled to begin at noon Thursday in the community room at the Bentonville Police Department. A new amphitheater will be unveiled tomorrow night at Mount Magazine State Park. The new Cameron Buffalo Amphitheater continues the tradition of the original amphitheater on the mountain, built in 1939 by the Works Progress Administration. The nearly 80-year-old amphitheater had, over time, fallen into disrepair because of weather and other factors before the mountain became a state park in 1983. The new amphitheater will seat 300 and will be available for rent. The ribbon cutting is tomorrow night at 6:30. And the National Weather Service says it is hot today, but likely it will be hotter later this week and potentially dangerous. Heat index values in western Arkansas and eastern Oklahoma by the weekend could be 110 degrees. There is a chance for thunderstorms next week that could bring some relief. Thank you.
on the next Fresh Air, how Steve Bannon helped Donald Trump get elected, from identifying and targeting white disaffected young men to mobilizing the anti-Clinton industry and emphasizing anti-immigration positions. We talk with journalist Joshua Green about his new book, Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. Join us.
Fresh Air every weekday at 11 a.m. and again at 6 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF. There really isn't an off-season for theater in the region. The Arts Center of the Ozarks will present its second weekend of Kiss Me, Kate later this week in downtown Springdale. And later this month, Arkansas Public Theater in Rogers stages its own summer musical, The Wedding Singer. And the Fort Smith Little Theater will open a Tony-winning musical, The Secret Garden, later this month. Theater Squared is busy in a different way after ground was broken last month for the company's eventual permanent home. And Michael J. Rhea, the chairperson of the University of Arkansas Theater Department, says the summer months are no time for him to check out either.
You know, as chair, I've learned over the last 4 years that the downtime is what you create. I mean, it's sort of my motivation to keep our program moving forward.
While Michael admits he will get some time off, the wheels are turning in several ways. The department is going through the final stages of preparing paperwork for accreditation and already eyeing the 2017-18 season. When he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News studio recently, I asked Michael if a growing arts region can help attract theater students to the U of A.
It does. It helps in recruiting for the MFA company especially. The undergraduate side, it's still the Razorbacks. That's what recruits. And, you know, we're looking to improve facilities and things all the time. So that's that. Students are very savvy today. They will choose a school that has technologies and equipment and facilities that they believe are going to take them to the next level. And sometimes we miss out, but sometimes also we are able to say, look, facilities are one thing, but look at the faculty we have here, and we have some amazing faculty. So that does help us quite a bit, too.
I want to ask you a few more infrastructure questions, but I'll do that later. Let's talk about the season. For those of us who are patrons, for those of us who sit in the seats and aren't students but just want to be entertained, I mean, you've got what I think is what you want out of a season. There is a classic, a timeless classic by Tennessee Williams. Mm-hmm. There is a contemporary classic. And there's some work that we may not know. Let's start with Tennessee Williams. What kind of discussion goes into, we want to do The Glass Menagerie? It's not an unfamiliar script. What kind of discussions go on with that?
You know, the director of this piece, Cole Wimpy, is a third-year MFA grad candidate, and he is from New York. He's done a lot of independent work where he's had to be the director, the producer, the set designer, the costume designer, the everybody. And in New York, if you don't do something that catches someone's eye, if you just do the same, if you do your grandfather's Glass Menagerie, I have to say grandfather now, to me, it's not necessarily the most opportune way to connect with today's audiences. So this director has taken a look at the original script when Joel Melziner, the set designer, was sitting in the audience with Tennessee Williams, and they were talking about this piece from its inception. And there's some pretty interesting features in the original idea, which were projections and to show the subconscious and to show what was inside the mind of these characters. And when they got to producing it, those were all cut in the original because it didn't work. And now we're back, and I think there are ways that today it works in a better way because our technology is better. We know more of what an audience might want to have without being too descriptive and disengage their imagination. So now it's more colorful. It's less in your face. It's much more imaginative. So this production is going to see a fairly sparse, contemporary look to the environment with a lot of visual imagery on this bare bones, I'll say, set of the apartment, but it's a skeleton of their life. So I'm very excited.
That opens the season.
That opens the season.
And then is Avenue Q next?
Avenue Q is our second show, and that we're
not bare bones.
Not bare bones. You know, everyone says, "Oh, you're doing that little show, Avenue Q." Yep, it's a facade. It's three brownstone apartments, buildings. But I'm telling you, there are more tricks in that set than you can shake a stick at. And to make it even more complicated, we are utilizing the original Broadway design. We bought the plans from Anna Luises, who was the scenic designer for that production. She's a friend of mine, and now we wanted to learn a new process. How do you stage an already conceived and a show that works based on that set? It's sort of like Noises Off. If you don't do the Noises Off set the way Noises Off is designed, the show falls apart. Mm-hmm. It's based on timing and doors, and this is the same way. So we got her permission. We paid her royalty. We are reproducing the Broadway set with our team of scenic artists, and we've got some amazing ones right now working on it.
After Avenue Q?
Avenue Q, Life is a Dream, Calderon's piece, which is being rewritten by a third-year graduate student to sort of tighten it up. I'm not sure, you know, if a lot of people are aware of this piece, but it is sort of a wonderful piece about dream versus reality and father and son relationships. And it's I think it's a really great sort of philosophical allegory story that we're going to be presenting. And then to wrap up our main stage season, which we call main stage just because it's one of our four big productions, is something new for us. Because we have two third-year playwrights, Paul McGinnis and Megan McHenry, they will be featuring their third-year productions in some form. It could be an advanced staged reading. It could be a little bit more of a production, but we are focusing, again, not on production values as far as spending tons of money on scenery. They're still developing these pieces. And our head of playwriting, John Walsh, is writing a piece specifically for our third-year MFA graduates. Mm. So it's a piece where he's getting to know the grad students, and he's going to write a piece for them to showcase their talents. And we are bringing in Theater for One from New York City. Theater for One is a one-on-one, one audience member, one performer in a road box, sort of like a small peep show where the door opens up and you get a six-minute monologue by a professional actor.
One-on-one.
One-on-one. And you are as close as you and I are together. So when I've seen this in New York City, and when the monologue begins, can you believe this past election? You don't know what to do.
Oh, wow.
You don't know how. So it is the most intimate moments of theater. And sometimes you don't know if you're going to get a monologue, or it could be a juggling act, or it could be someone reading an obituary of someone they loved. It is a personal moment between the actor and the audience member.
It seems like that heightens the importance of your role as audience. Because the only feedback the performer is getting is from you.
Yep. And they can see you because there's not lighting to distract them that blinds their eyes, which typically happens in a proscenium theater.
So you've seen this in New York.
Yes, I've gone through.
You've been an audience member.
I've been an audience member for three of the pieces of that evening. You see one, you get back in line, and you see the next one, and you see the next one. And it's just a circle of opportunity.
Well, let me tell you what I would struggle with a little bit here. So when it's over, I'd want to talk to the person. I'd want to say, oh, about this, or good job, or do you applaud? I mean, what happens?
The door shuts, and you get up and you walk out. We're hoping to create a partnership and relationship with the city and have it down on the square because it's going to be in April, so the farmers market will be open, so we want that to be a presence. If our black box is completed, we would have it down there. We've expressed interest in taking it up to Crystal Bridges. It's expensive to bring it, mm-hmm. but the opportunities for our students to not only learn to perform in this type of an environment, our designers are going to be designing soundscapes, and lighting is very minimal, but yeah. We're going to give new young designers an opportunity to work on this on a very limited production opportunity. But it's really exciting. It's something. If you've never experienced small theater, and we think Theater Squared has a small intimate space, and it does.
Well, it does.
Take this in times 100, and you are literally in the laps of the performer.
You mentioned the black box.
Yes. Well, I've been here since 1992, and all of the wonderful things that this university has provided for our students and for myself as an artist, it's been amazing. The one thing we've always struggled with is space is an opportunity to grow. And we had an opportunity 3 years ago to take over occupancy of the Global Campus Auditorium, which it's called
Continuing Ed years ago.
Continuing Ed. Because it had been sitting idle for a long, long time. It was too small for certain events and too big for others. Arts Live utilized it, and the Arkansas Fayetteville Film Festival mm-hmm. used it. So we were given the opportunity to turn it into a pedagogical opportunity. So we teach classes down there, and we took it as is. And we put some lighting equipment into it and updated a little bit. The dean of the Fulbright College provided some funding to help with that. But it was still a Band-Aid. And I don't know, you know the space. It's mm-hmm. a very short proscenium, very little stage space. Yeah. No wing space, no dressing rooms, no green room to speak of. But it was an opportunity for us to take advantage of space. So we did. Well, fast forward a year and a half, Don Judges, the new interim vice provost for distance education, which is Global Campus, is renovating fourth and fifth floor. And there was discussion of adding a sixth floor onto that building and doing an outdoor sort of bar reception. He said, mm-hmm. hey, if we do that, would you produce more theater down here? And I said, we really can't because it's not a proper theater. He said, what would you need to do? And I said, gut it, put a flat floor in, put a grid in, put dressing rooms, put, you know, equip it. He said, what would that cost? I said, I don't know, a couple million, three, 4 million, something like that. Fast forward, he presented the idea. He was my champion. We ran with it to Mike Johnson and to our dean, and he said, this sounds good. Not sure how we're going to do it. At the time, we were going through accreditation preliminary visits, and the accreditor said to us, you look very good on paper, but you don't have enough space. And I said, what if? And they said, well, that would certainly help your cause. So that became part of our motivation, is to help us become accredited along with art and music, who are both now accredited. Music's been accredited a while. So fast forward again to this spring, and Todd Shields, as the dean, said, look, I believe in the program. I believe in the trajectory that it's been exhibiting. We need to find a way to have this opportunity and have an opportunity for audiences to connect to the U of A on the square. To us, that's critical. There's the art gallery now over in the Pryor Center.
Right.
The art students have the basement.
And the Pryor Center.
And the Pryor Center now. That's part of Fulbright.
Right.
We will be able to host guests there if there's overflow and they want to have a presentation. We can equip up to 150 seats. It can be in any configuration, proscenium, in the round, thrust. It's going to be a dynamite space, and it's going to create an energy, I think, that has been missing on the square proper for live theater. And we also hope to work with the Roots Festival and make that a music venue during that, have it be open during farmers markets so parents could bring their kids and do an improv workshop with our graduate students and our undergraduate students, do scene painting demonstrations down there during these opportunities, just ways for us to connect with the community. To show them what we're doing down, you know, as far as live theater goes.
And going back full circle to how we started this conversation, recruiting.
Yeah.
I mean, it helps,
definitely,
right?
It's definitely going to make a huge impact on our ability, especially for directors, playwrights. They're going to have a home in which they will have 24/7 access to, which will be great. They will be able to be in there without the restrictions of a campus closing. And, you know, right now our studio theater is in Kimple Hall and the building gets locked around 10 p.m., 11 p.m. And there are ways to get it to stay open, but we're also jeopardizing the other units that are in there by opening the entire building. So it is the proper thing to have us in our own space like that. So.
Now, we've talked about the main stage. We've talked about the black box. What have I missed about the 17-18 season?
Well, we also will have two studio productions in addition to our main stage. Right now, we're waiting until we see what our incoming class of freshmen looks like. And at that point, our faculty will make a determination as to, do we have a lot more females? Do we have more males? We will pick a show appropriate for that group of students. There will be auditions, and we just don't have a title yet. And those will probably be in 404 or, depending on the venue availability, somewhere else within the city. But we know that Global Campus will be offline until at least, they think, February. So I'm thinking March or April.
Michael J. Rhea is the chairperson of the University of Arkansas Theater Department. This is Ozarks at Large.
we know why exercise can give us some protection, maybe we can help design our therapeutics better, be that our exercise intervention or something else. But then hopefully we can, it eventually translates up to things that we can do with policy and promotion of activity and those sorts of things.
Diabetes prevention on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals and the Springfield Cardinals will battle again tonight in Missouri after the Cards defeated the Nats last night 4-1. The Naturals' next home game is Thursday night at 7:05 against Tulsa at RS Ballpark in Springdale. Three athletes with ties to the University of Arkansas are competing this week at the World Diving Championships in Hungary. Nicole Gillis, representing South Africa, a senior at the U of A in the fall, is joining two women about to start their collegiate careers later this year at the championships in Budapest. One of the Razorback newcomers is Brooke Schultz, daughter of Arkansas diving coach Dale Schultz, who's an assistant coach for Team USA at the World Championships. The championships continue through the week. The U of A cross-country team schedules are now final. The women's team seeking a fourth straight SEC championship, and the men's team, coming off a fifth-place national finish last year, will both open the 2017 season at a meet in Stillwater, Oklahoma, on Friday, September 1st. The first home meet for both teams will be the annual Chili Pepper Festival at Agri Park, Saturday, September 30th. That's the only time either Razorback squad is scheduled to run in Fayetteville this fall. The city of Springdale will host 10 Cal Ripken baseball teams from Arkansas and Texas beginning later this week for the 12-year-old Major 60 Southwest Regional Baseball Tournament at C.L. Charlie and Willie George Park. The opening ceremonies for the tournament will be at the park Thursday night beginning at 6. The team that wins this tournament advances to the national championships in Clemson, South Carolina next month. And if you have thought to yourself the state of Arkansas could use one more college football team, you may be encouraged to know the University of Arkansas Little Rock is studying that possibility. Officials at the school announced last week they plan to study if a football team at the college is a good idea and to find out if there's enough community support for the idea. UALR did have a team when it was a two-year college and won the national championship for such schools in 1949. The last time UALR had a team was in 1955. John Brummett, a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, has taken notice of the suggestion that UALR could add football to the college's resume. In his weekly conversation with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics, he suggests that the desire to add Division I football to the state's largest city is not something just for the sports page.
Well, it's not a sports story. This seems to be the local approach to how to make Little Rock great again. We're going to, it's like a threefer, not a twofer, but a threefer. It's gonna heal our community. It's gonna hear the city leaders and state leaders take. It's gonna heal our community. It's gonna stop this. It's gonna improve the stagnant enrollment at ULR, and it's gonna make vibrant again War Memorial Stadium. So they're going to study whether all this will happen. I think none of that happens if we have a Sunbelt last place football team out at UALR. And running up massive deficits and charging incredible student athletic fees in order to pay for it. I think it's a lame idea, and I also think it just reflects the simplicity of our thinking and just this silliness of our obsession with college football or college athletics. I root for the Razorbacks most of the time.
You certainly have a lot of commentary
To offer this as some sort of community enhancement or perhaps even a panacea is just absurd. And it has so little to do with college. Do you know the basketball team does no longer calls itself UALR? They're called Little Rock.
That's right.
They just take the university out of it. And who are these people?
Everybody calls Fayetteville, Fayetteville.
No, they call that the Razorbacks.
But they also call it Fayetteville. Where do you go to school? I go to school at Fayetteville.
Okay.
That's the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, but I go to school at Fayetteville. They're trying to capture that same kind of spirit there. Where do you go to school? Little Rock. Okay.
They do not call it the Fayetteville Razorbacks. It's the University of Arkansas Razorbacks. And who are these people?
They're millennials. You got to get with the times, John. Come on now.
Roby.
You're getting stodgy in your old age.
No, I just want to. I just see hypocrisy and banality and absurdity where it is, and I want to know who are they? They say that this will help UALR's enrollment. I want to round up the people who are not now going to college, but will go to UALR if they have a football team. I want to see them. I want to ask them, what is it about UALR having a football team that just compels you to get into biology lab that you wouldn't have gone into before?
Right. We'll these are my questions. Them to you. You've thrown down the gauntlet. We'll see if they respond. Mm-hmm. What's your idea for making Little Rock great again?
Making Little Rock great again requires a full police force and stricter crime fighting at the police level. It also requires a strong political leadership, visionary leadership that brings together the forces that are cancerously divided in this community. You've got to get from Chennault to the east side, and you've got from the south side to the Heights, and you've got to get people talking to each other and caring about each other and working together, and that is and that's the only way it can be attacked. I'm not going to say solved, but attacked. And let's see if it happens.
John Brumman is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns can also be found at ArkansasOnline.com. He talked with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics. You can see and hear more from their discussion at TalkBusiness.net. Also at TalkBusiness.net, an update on stories involving Arkansas news, business, and politics. This is Ozarks at Large.
91.3 is supported by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include American College of Radiology certified imaging departments, infusion centers, pharmacy, clinical trials, and more. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. Additional support provided by David Adams Fine Jewelry, offering design, creation, and repair of all jewelry in silver, gold, and platinum. All work performed in-house. Diamond and colored stone designs are on display at the downtown Fayetteville Square Gallery and online at davidadams.com.
Before digital projectors invaded movie theaters, films were played from, well, film. And projectionists needed quick reflexes to flip from one reel to the next.
The cue marks were a sixth of a second. So if you had a normal blink, you could have, oh, did I just miss that?
I'm Audie Cornish. We climb into the projection booth this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 3 to 6 on 91.3. We've certainly had our share of stories about entrepreneurship in Northwest and Western Arkansas recently, and the push doesn't seem to be slowing. Yesterday, all the way across Arkansas, a big step for new ventures in Jonesboro. Arkansas State University is launching the A-State Innovation System. It's designed to provide opportunities for entrepreneurs to access resources and bring ideas to the marketplace. The system is a public-private partnership between Arkansas State, Ritter Communications, the Arkansas Economic Development Commission, and the Delta Regional Authority. Governor Asa Hutchinson says it's important the state provide funds to help such efforts, especially with the technology and STEM efforts the state has been making.
Proud of the fact that we have over 5,500 students in Arkansas taking computer coding. And when those students come out with some background in computer coding, guess where they want to go? They want to go to the shop, they want to go to the garage, they want to go to Makerspace, they want to have a capacity and support for their creative ideas, which is what computer science is all about. And so we have to have the future, we have to look to the future, and it is technology, it is innovation, and it cannot happen in the state of Arkansas without technology and innovation being strong in the northeast corridor of our state.
Dedication ceremonies were held in downtown Jonesboro at one of the three locations the innovation system will be housed in across the city. The innovation system is made up of a collaboration and makerspace, a machine shop, and a research lab. And that's just part of the story in the eastern half of Arkansas this week when it comes to pumping more life into the state's economy. About 30 educators will tour 14 factories across eastern Arkansas through the week. It is for the second annual STEM Manufacturers Tour, hosted by U.S. Representative Rick Crawford and Arkansas State University's Education Renewal Zone. Representative Crawford says he hopes the tour will help students understand that there are multiple pathways to success after high school.
We hope this enhances that and that our educators get a better view of exactly what's out there in the First District, in our economy, and throughout this region, and the partnerships that exist through institutions like Arkansas State University, the community colleges under the system umbrella, and a variety of other institutions that are really plugged into the industry that exists here to help drive that education.
Factories the group will visit include Riceland in Arkansas County and Big River Steel in Mississippi County. Over 82% of manufacturers in Arkansas report a lack of skilled production workers.
Hi, this is Lee Wood, KUAF's membership director. If you could double the amount of your donation without giving another dollar, wouldn't you want to do it? Well, if your employer has a matching contribution program, you may be able to double the impact of your giving to KUAF that easily. Many companies in our listening area have matching contribution programs, often matching gifts up to 100%. To see if your employer has a matching contribution program or to submit a match application, call me at 479-575-7259.
91.3 is supported by Clubhouse Fitness, helping Arkansans develop healthy habits through personal training, over 70 classes weekly, and access to outdoor activities. Located in Fayetteville, Little Rock, and online, clubhausfitness.com. The 67th season of Opera in the Ozarks continues through July 21st at Inspiration Point in Eureka Springs. It features nearly 50 vocalists from across the nation performing Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, Bizet's Carmen, and Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. Sunday performances held at Arend Arts Center in Bentonville, July 2nd, 9th, and 16th. Tickets at opera.org.
A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville. Fort Smith, Rogers, and West Fork. We'll end the show with music from the Truman Rail Boys. They'll be at Black Apple Crossing in downtown Springdale Saturday night. Music begins at 8. You can learn more at the Truman Rail Boys Facebook page, Truman with two N's. This is the Truman Rail Boys performing He Was No Devil inside the Carver Center for Public Radio. Have a great rest of your Tuesday.